Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. First thing this morning, what you need to know about Al-Qaeda 2.0, or maybe it's 3.0 or 4.0. Today is the anniversary of the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in East Africa, one of Al-Qaeda's first high-profile attacks. With this week's terror alerts, intercepted messages from leaders in Yemen and U.S. officials like Congressman Peter King saying things like this.
Al-Qaeda is in many ways stronger than it was before 9/11 because it's mutated and it's spread and it can come out of some different directions.
Let's take a step back and ask just what is Al-Qaeda 2013? We know it is not a worldwide network led by Osama bin Laden bent on high-profile attacks here in the U.S., but we also know it's still enough of a force to close 19 embassies for a week, an unprecedented move on the part of the State Department. NPR's national security correspondent Dina Temple-Raston is here to explain what you need to know about the new Al-Qaeda and to answer your questions. Dina, thank you so much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
So we'll get your assessment of Peter King's statement in just a moment, but first let's define a very important glossary term that has entered our vocabulary, AQAP. What is AQAP and why is it this week's most important acronym?
Well, it's been an important acronym when it comes to Al-Qaeda for some time now, probably for the last 4 or 5 years. AQAP stands for Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And the best way to sort of place it is to just think of it as being Al-Qaeda's affiliate or franchise in Yemen. Al-Qaeda has a handful of affiliates. There's one in Iraq, for example, that's been gaining strength over the last 6 months or so. All those car bombings you hear about in Iraq, the rash of car bombings, AQ or Al-Qaeda in Iraq is thought to be behind those. There's one in the Islamic Maghreb. They sent a lot of fighters to Libya. There's one in Somalia. But Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is considered the most dangerous. It was behind, do you remember the underwear bombing in 2009 where
yes,
a young Nigerian man got on a plane bound for Detroit? The underwear bomb misfired and just burned him, but it could have taken down the plane. They also tried to send bombs on cargo planes about a year after that. They were hidden inside printer cartridges. And I talked to a bomb tech who had actually seen this bomb that AQAP's master bomb maker, Ashiri, had made. And he called it, and this was his words, a thing of beauty. It was that good.
How big of an organization is AQAP? When we talk about the network, is it 20 people, 200 people, 2,000 people? What?
Well, it used to be a couple of hundred people. It now, over the last sort of couple of years, has really grown, and it's thought to be, according to the State Department, about 2,000 people. Most of the recruits in the early days were just people who were young jihadis who had heard so much about the organization and maybe gone to Yemen to take language training and then would slip away from their language training schools to they were learning standard Arabic. They would leave those schools and join up with AQAP. Increasingly, they have had a lot of local people join. And the question is whether or not these people are joining because they were against the previous government in Yemen and felt that AQAP was fighting the government, or whether or not there was some response to U.S. drone attacks in Yemen. Nobody's really been able to get a handle on why they have grown so quickly.
And Dina, we want our listeners to have an opportunity to ask you questions about Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Yemen, or Al-Qaeda today. What do you want to know, listeners? Ask Dina Temple-Raston, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. The phones are open. And Dina, any reaction to the news just breaking now about a large-scale terror plot in Yemen? The government there says that it has foiled an Al-Qaeda plot to blow up gas facilities and other infrastructure. Does that fit the AQAP tactical approach?
It does very much. What I'm finding interesting about this, and remember, this is just broken, so I haven't been able to make quite the number of phone calls I would like to sort of chase this down.
Yes, of course.
But what's interesting about it is how they are highlighting this as an amazing, enormous attack by AQAP. And one of the things they wanted to do was actually blow up pipelines and maybe seize a couple of cities and seize ports. AQAP has tried to do this a bunch of times, and they've never been successful. So I'm not quite sure why this is being dubbed something that was a real possibility. They are always attacking pipelines. They're always trying to sort of cause these kind of skirmishes, and they haven't been that good at it. And I'm not quite sure yet why it is the Yemeni government is seeing this as different than the things that AQAP has tried to do against the government in the past.
Is the Yemeni's government a fair broker in fighting al-Qaeda?
What do you mean by fair broker?
Well, in this latest story, for example, the government suggesting that it foiled an al-Qaeda plot to blow up the gas facilities and infrastructure. Can we rely upon the government in our efforts to foil al-Qaeda?
Well, here's the thing. You have to before President Hadi, who is the current president now of Yemen, and then there was the time during President Saleh, who was essentially, because of the Arab Spring, he ended up having to step down because there was so much protest in the streets of Yemen. President Saleh played a double game. He definitely would help the Americans at one point and then be incredibly unhelpful at another point. In fact, there is a particular terrorist, Jaber el-Banna, who was an American. He grew up in Lackawanna, just outside of Buffalo, and he was part of this so-called Lackawanna Six, the young men who went to an al-Qaeda camp about 6 months before, or came back about 6 months before the 9/11 attacks. And Jaber el-Banna has been for some time on what law enforcement officials in this country call a catch-and-release program, that President Saleh's government would grab him and say, okay, we'll give him back to you, and then sort of weeks later, as they were trying to negotiate what reward they would get for Jaber el-Banna, they would release him again. Hmm. Last time I heard, he was driving a taxi in Yemen.
Hmm. Well, let's come back to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula itself. Who makes up the core? If now the organization may be as many as a couple thousand people or more, who makes up the core, the leadership of the organization, if it's even possible to pin that down?
Well, the most important name for your listeners to remember is a guy named Wu Heishi. Wu Heishi is considered the leader of AQAP, but something very interesting just happened. And what happened is he was named number two of the core organization. So Ayman al-Zawahiri is the one who took Osama bin Laden's place as the so-called leader of al-Qaeda core. And just in the last sort of 3 or 4 weeks, apparently Wu Heishi, the leader of AQAP, was brought to be in charge of all operations for all of al-Qaeda's affiliates, all these ones I mentioned a little bit earlier. And that is a management change, and that is something that intelligence analysts are looking at very carefully. I mean, one of the questions was whether or not all this talk about a possible attack against Western targets was something that was supposed to commemorate Wu Heishi's elevation to this sort of chief of operations spot in al-Qaeda's core organization.
And is Wu Heishi one of the men who escaped from that prison break in Yemen back in 06?
He is one of those people, yes. There was it's a fantastic story in a lot of ways. Basically, what they did, using table legs and spoons, they built a tunnel out from under this prison. And then they had people who were helping them on the other side actually digging from inside a woman's bathroom in a nearby mosque.
Wow.
And it was either 150 feet or 150 yards of tunnel that they actually escaped that way. So it was pretty clear they had help. You know, this gets back to your other question of whether or not the past government of President Saleh was helping the U.S. or sort of playing a double game. There are also two other key people. There's a guy named who's just recently actually been killed. His name was Saeed al-Shiri. He was the deputy of the group. But what was important about him is he was a former detainee at Guantanamo Bay, and he graduated from a Saudi rehabilitation program and then basically helped construct AQAP. And then the second man is Ibrahim al-Rubaysh. He's their top religious leader. He was also at Guantanamo, and he escaped from the Saudi rehab program shortly after he went to Saudi Arabia from Guantanamo.
Let's take a call, Dina, from Elaine. She's in Brooklyn. Elaine, you're on with Dina Temple-Raston.
Good morning. I have a question I've wondered about for years. What's the difference between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban? They seem to be interchangeable entities. What are the differences?
Elaine, thank you so much for your call. Dina, will you please answer that?
Well, there is some overlap, particularly the Pakistani Taliban in Pakistan has some overlap with Al-Qaeda. I think the easiest way to tell the difference is that Al-Qaeda has a different goal than the Taliban does. Al-Qaeda is hoping to set up a caliphate, sort of homeland for all Muslims, and it is very focused on attacking the United States. The Taliban, while it attacks the United States in Afghanistan and sometimes in Pakistan, its whole essence is to get the U.S. out of Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's much more focused closer to home on Pakistan than and its goals there rather than, for example, trying to bring down the infidels, which is much more of what Al-Qaeda is about.
Which gives us a chance to take a step back and talk about Al-Qaeda's structure, its current structure. Let's take a listen to three clips of President Obama from the 2012 campaign trail.
Al-Qaeda is on the path to defeat, and Osama bin Laden is dead.
So we decimated Al-Qaeda's core leadership in the border regions between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And today, Al-Qaeda's on the run, and Osama bin Laden is dead.
Now, Dina, obviously, President Obama is running for office there. He's trying to trumpet the death of Osama bin Laden. But how accurate was it for him to say it then, and how accurate is it now?
Well, I think what he was talking about was Al-Qaeda's core, which is true. Al-Qaeda's core has been decimated. Its middle management and its upper management, with the exception of Zawahiri, has been decimated by drone attacks. In fact, one of the sort of jokes within the terrorism community is that if Al-Qaeda doesn't like you, it makes you their number three, their operations guy, because every couple of months the operation guy was getting killed by either drones or some other thing. So if you were one or two or four, it meant Al-Qaeda liked you. But as soon as they made you three, it meant you were on the outs. So in that respect, it was decimated. But you know, the Peter King clip that you started with at the top of this, you know, in which he said in many ways Al-Qaeda is stronger than it was, before 9/11. I think that's a little exaggerated. What really is going on is that Al-Qaeda is very, very good at adapting. And we've been saying for years on the air that Al-Qaeda core had started moving projects out to its affiliates. And that happened maybe 4 or 5 years ago, where the affiliates were taking much more of the sort of frontline operational tasks. And the core theoretically was trying to direct this. And there were some things that came out of the Abbottabad compound. This is where they killed Osama bin Laden. Some of the intelligence that came out of there showed that Osama bin Laden was writing a lot of letters and sending them through couriers to a lot of these different affiliates. And there's some division over how much the affiliates were really listening to him. One intelligence person told me it was sort of like a CEO who was trying to have control over his franchises, but his franchises weren't listening. Example, Al-Qaeda's arm called AQIM, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. They were the people who were behind that BP oil facility attack late last year. That group, Osama bin Laden had told them over and over again he wanted them to stop kidnapping because and they were collecting huge ransoms to finance terrorism. He said it made them look like common criminals. And AQIM completely ignored him on this.
Your comment about adapting, Al-Qaeda adapting, and the move into the modern world brings immediately to mind this Daily Beast report today, this morning, about this big conference call between more than 20 Al-Qaeda operatives reportedly throughout the Middle East, Asia, the Arab world. Did that story surprise you? And what does that say about Al-Qaeda adapting and how dispersed Al-Qaeda is today in a new way, different from post-9/11 Al-Qaeda?
Well, Al-Qaeda has been let me take the second part first. Al-Qaeda has been dispersed for some time. Basically, anywhere there's a vacuum of power and it's a Muslim country, Al-Qaeda tries to go there and take advantage. And a lot of the sort of rebel groups in these countries, take Somalia, where there was a group called Al-Shabaab or Students, okay? They basically took on the Al-Qaeda moniker because it made them seem more powerful. And in the beginning, they didn't have that many links to Al-Qaeda, but they just sort of wanted to burnish their own image. I think that the thing that people don't understand about the new Al-Qaeda is that it's been morphing in this direction for some time. And as I said earlier, I think the key thing that we're looking at now to see how it's changed more recently is this idea that Ayman al-Zawahiri is Osama bin Laden's replacement or and Wu Heishi, this guy who's AQAP's leader, making him a key operational guy for all of the affiliates is very, very important. Does this show that there's some sort of management change that's coming there because Zawahiri maybe feels too pinned down and needs someone to take control? Or is there more than Zawahiri can actually handle? And that's the reason why he's appointed this very well-known deputy. Wu Heishi, incidentally, used to be Osama bin Laden's secretary, like his administrator. So he has ties. Yes, exactly, exactly.
And just on a fundamental level, what kind of technology do they use for, say, a conference call? I mean, do they have their own phone network? Do they use GoToMeeting like the rest of us? I mean, I know it sounds so fundamental, but how are they communicating with such a vast number of people involved?
Well, this is why I meant to answer the conference call question. I apologize for not doing that when you first asked it. I find this fantastic. If it is actually true, it shows so much lack of tradecraft that we have seen Al-Qaeda use up to now that I find it hard to believe. In fact, there is some question when we first started reporting this communication that was between Wu Heishi and Zawahiri, which is apparently the thing that sort of got this latest warning and threat, got the U.S. so spooled up. I found it fantastic, as did a lot of my sources. They kept calling it a conversation, but wouldn't really say it was a phone call, because these phone calls can be intercepted, right? I mean, there are drones flying all over, waiting for this kind of thing, a number to come up that they might be able to catch. And it was said about Osama bin Laden that nothing with an electron came within 100 feet of him. Because he was so concerned about what the U.S. might be able to pick up. In fact, he actually wore a cowboy hat around the house because he thought if drones were able to somehow see inside the Abbottabad compound, the cowboy hat would make them think that this was not, you know, possibly Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. Their tradecraft just wouldn't – it seems crazy to me that many people would make themselves vulnerable on a conference call. Yeah. Let's just assume that maybe Zawahiri and Wu Heishi might, you know, just the two of them in a quick phone call saying, go ahead, you know, I want you to hurry up and do that plan that we did. But, you know, there's drones all over Somalia. And the report talks about how 20 different people were
more
on
than
the same
20
call.
Al-Qaeda operatives.
Significant people. If that's true, either they are supremely confident or our ability to find these people isn't as good as history has suggested.
Or perhaps a combination of both.
Yes. And also maybe. But I also think that they don't, you know, they don't use cell phones. They are really careful about these sorts of things. I mean, I'm sure you heard the story that the courier al-Kuwaiti, who eventually led the U.S. to Osama bin Laden, he took the SIM card out of his phone and would not put it back in his phone until he was at least 2 hours away from the compound. And if you know that and that tradecraft, and you know that that tradecraft is something that Osama bin Laden passed along to Zawahiri, can you really imagine there being a conference call?
And I should mention that we do have a call or two on this very point about modern technology and Al-Qaeda's use thereof and the extent to which terrorism has become even virtual and online. But we're tight on time, and I have to ask you a little bit more about the role of drone strikes. Because one of the earliest drone strikes ever used against Al-Qaeda was in Yemen back in 2002, killing several top leaders.
And in American.
Yes, yes. And
Kamel
go
Derwish.
Ahead. Right.
Kamel Derwish, the American who was killed, was actually the one who recruited the Lackawanna Six.
And we all know, of course, the long and storied tale of drone strikes and the complicated political implications of them. And Yemen expert Greg Johnson reported just this week that one of the lessons drawn from that 02 attack was to disperse al-Qaeda, the leadership and the membership, to avoid having it all wiped out again in the same way. So is that the effect, Dina Temple-Raston, to disperse the al-Qaeda leadership in ways that we did not anticipate back in 2002?
Well, I think al-Qaeda was always moving this direction. They never wanted to be just one core organization. The way Osama bin Laden had always envisioned the group was to have these satellites or these franchises and affiliates and people fighting what he called the near war and the far war, the near war being what was going on in that particular country and the far war or far enemy being the United States. I think what is interesting is that drones have changed this enough that the U.S. is finding handbooks that operatives have that basically talk about how to avoid a drone seeing you. You know, move at night, stay in the trees. And drones are something that not only affect al-Qaeda, but affect people on the ground, say, for example, in Pakistan. If you talk to people on the ground in Pakistan who are near where a lot of these drone strikes have happened, they actually have PTSD from the drone sound that they hear constantly. Mm. It just makes them feel like at any moment a missile might come out of something. And this is one of the really big issues in Pakistan.
And of course, it's become a recruiting tool as well.
Yeah, people say that. It's not entirely clear that's true. I mean, certainly Faisal Shahzad, the guy who had the kind of smoke bomb in the car in Times Square, he says that's why he went to attack. But, you know, people have said that, but it's really unclear whether or not that's true.
Well, Dina Temple-Raston, we can't thank you enough for being with us this morning.
I'm always happy to be here. Thank you. It's great to see you.
Dina Temple-Raston is, of course, NPR's counterterrorism and national security reporter. And listeners, we've posted a reading list on our website, 5 articles we recommend about al-Qaeda, Yemen, and national security. WMYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer on WMYC and at WNYC.org. Up next, President Obama canceled his one-on-one meeting with Putin this morning. And we're going to talk about the state of U.S.-Russia relations in the post-Snowden era back in a minute.